On Tuesday, January 17, 2006, the Winnipeg Free Press delivered troublesome news to the Winnipeg roller skating community when it announced that a private holding company had worked out a tentative deal to buy the 25,000 square foot complex and the property at Portage Avenue and Langside Street. That complex was a historic downtown institution, Galaxy Skateland, formerly known as the Winnipeg Roller Rink, and the buyer was the University of Winnipeg. Legend and historical record established that the building was originally constructed between 1890 and 1908. The Winnipeg Roller Rink was once the largest in Canada and was one of the only rinks before its demolition in 2008 to retain its original gleaming maple hardwood floors, placing the rink as historically significant to leisure culture in Canada. Galaxy Skateland is not an unusual case. Scores of other rinks across North America experienced similar fates due in part to their decrepit buildings and a declining pool of roller skaters. The history of the rink remains highly contested and exhibits many contradictions despite the efforts of the Winnipeg Roller Rink's past customers and employees who have taken to collecting and recounting the history of the building over the years. The first evidence in the Manitoba Free Press of existence of a roller skating rink at the corner of Langside Street and Portage Avenue is from an advertisement in the December 12th edition of the paper from 1908. The ad indicates that the owner of the building at this time was W.J. Holmes. An article in the Manitoba Historical Society written in 1985 by Myron Love disagrees with this proposition. This article illustrates that the building was first listed in the Henderson's Directory in 1906. Mr. J.B. Kalu was listed as the proprietor of the livery stable, and the building's first address was on Furby Place. In about 1912, W.J. Holmes opened the Winnipeg Skating Rink in part of the building. Star Livery and Holmes Ice Skating Rink shared the location for about 5 years. Fred Verity, who was interviewed in the 1985 article, also recalled in a more recent interview that the rink was originally Holmes' livery stable and linked the once open ceiling to this history.
That building originally was Holmes' livery stable.
Looking down the rink, it was right on the right side, the very back. There was two big doors that swung open, and then out there was that's where they used to the livery stable. Well, there was other doors too where they brought in the horses.
Ron Korn, a former regular of the rink during the roller disco era, recounted a similar story.
In the 1800s, it was a horse stable, and then they had ice skating in it, and then they did roller skating, and then after roller skating was so good, they just turned it into a roller rink, and it was a roller rink ever since.
Keith Haycock echoed similar stories about the horse stable legend.
That building was built in 1901, and it was a delivery stable. Then it went to a hockey rink, and then it went to a full-time roller rink.
Advertisements from the 1905 and 1906 in the Winnipeg Free Press confirmed that J.B. Kalu did in fact own a livery stable on Langside Street during those 2 years. However, its exact location cannot be pinpointed by the use of the press. Former owner, Andre Atkinson, affirmed in an interview that the building was
very old, needed lots of work. It was a wooden structure. So I guess over the years, the wood was rotting and the roof was starting to fall down. So it wasn't a very well-built building. It wasn't like masonry or steel, it was just wood. And I guess I was told it was a livery stable in the early 1900s, but I can't confirm that. Because we, Joe and myself, we went to the library to look up, and we couldn't find anything past or before like the 1920s. There was just nothing there. So I don't know how far back it goes.
The official history has the architect James McDermott building the Winnipeg Skating Rink in 1908 from the ground up. But Atkinson believes the city's heritage department got the history of the structure wrong. He says old-time Galaxy patrons have all told the same handed-down story, that McDermott established the rink inside a livery stable that dated back to the late 1800s.
Because we found, when we were looking, we found other things with addresses and stuff that went back to the 1800s. So I thought, well, why wouldn't this building be there? I mean, the stories are, yeah, it goes back to 1890 or something, right?
According to them, in 1908, McDermott only built the front section of the changing rooms, offices, a waiting room, and a concession area. The report includes evidence of a 12-stall stable built in 1905. According to a planning map at the City Archives, it sat just north of the Winnipeg Skating Rink, the Heritage Report concludes. It is clear that it was a completely new building, not, as some reports have stated, the conversion of a much older stable. Curtis Devers, former manager at the rink during the 2000s, is however not convinced that such a building would be designed for skating.
When we were working on the back of the rink, did we not find very large hinges kind of entombed in the wall? Remember?
But that could have been in the 1920s.
That's true. Ooh. Those were some big doors for a roller rink.
Whether it is true or not, the livery stable legend is an important tradition, and its purpose is to help make sense of the interesting architectural design of the building and to present the rink as an important Winnipeg landmark. Regardless of when the building was originally constructed, skating at Langside Street and Portage Avenue in Winnipeg began in 1908 and progressed until 2007. W.J. Holmes continued to own and operate the rink throughout the 1920s, and between 1929 and 1933, W.J. Dixon bought the property and Sid Shaw managed the business. They began occasionally hosting roller skating parties at the ice rink, and vice versa when the rink changed its primary function from an ice skating rink to a roller rink.
There was three floors in the front of the building. The second floor was office and shops. Third floor, I believe, was a walkway that went down the center of the building. If you ever were in the rink, you would have noticed it was a drop ceiling. Well, before that, it was just green garbage bags wrapped down. They dropped the ceiling a lot, long, but it was just green garbage bags taped up on the roof. Mm-hmm. And it made it look like a drape system. There wasn't much heat. And in fact, when they started doing the roller rink, what they did was, in the winter, they would put sawdust on the hardwood floor and then put the water on it and make it an ice rink before they did it in 1933. That's the way they did it. The hardwood floor was in there earlier, and during the winter they just put sawdust down and then pour the water on top.
I guess they started roller skating in there in I guess the late 20s. They would put a temporary floor in there, and I guess they would skate and then take it out for ice skating or something, and then they finally put in the hardwood floor in 1933. And apparently they flooded it twice for ice skating still. They poured water all over it. That's why they ruined it, you know. It was starting to chip and fall apart, and then they stopped doing that. And it was roller skating ever since.
They had ice skating in it, and then they did roller skating. And then after roller skating was so good, they just turned it into a roller rink, and it was a roller rink ever since.
The 30s to now is no comparison. No comparison. They could stick 2,500 to 1,500 people on the skating floor on a Friday night with no problem.
By 1934, the name was changed to the Winnipeg Roller Rink, and the final purpose came into sight. In 1951, Shaw returned to Winnipeg, bought the rink, renovated the building, and installed a new floor. Following Shaw, Bill Angus owned the rink until he became ill in the late 1970s, upon which Winnipeg entrepreneur Bob Beach bought the rink.
The old owner, he got really sick in the mid-70s, and the other owner that bought the rink used to own Skinner's at Lockport. And he was a skater. And so the one guy announced at this one roller rink, he comes out and he says, "Well, kids, I have some bad news. It's the end of the season. This is the end of the roller skating rink. I can't look after it anymore, and there's not going to be another roller rink." And here this guy is this millionaire. He says, "Well, wait a minute." So he goes upstairs with the old owner, and 10 minutes later they come down. "Bob Beach just bought the rink." So when Bob Beach bought the rink, he had all these jukeboxes at Skinner's. And after this was at the end, he changed all the music and got rid of all that old music. And it was all top 40 music from the 70s. So it was like, oh my God, all of us found heaven.
In 1990, Andre Atkinson, the final owner, took over and changed the name to first DJ's Roller City and finally, in 1996, to Galaxy Skate Land.
I was like a few years older than him, and he told me when he was 14 he was going to own that place one day. And I just looked at him and I thought, oh, he has a dream. I hope it comes true. And sure enough, he did. Yeah, he did.
With the emergence of a middle class brought on by the Industrial Revolution, came new opportunities for a large portion of society to take part in recreation. Leisure was no longer a privilege that was only enjoyed by the upper classes of society. Historian Luna Lambert suggests that ice skating was the first modern, socially equal sport in America. Rinks became a place where the new class was able to exercise its new privileges. In 1863, James Plimpton invented the roller skate as a means of prolonging the skating season. In the 1880s, roller rinks popped up all over the industrial world. Working class young people were drawn to a new kind of rink. Roller skating quickly transitioned from a high cultural activity to one deemed lowbrow. Over the next 100 years, roller skating would see very little change in its cultural status. During the Great Depression in North America, people were in desperate need of affordable hobbies and pastimes. Furthermore, between 1926 and 1927, when talking soundtracks were integrated into films, movie theaters sold their now obsolete organs to roller rinks, and the culture was revived. During the 1930s and 1940s, the city's three roller rinks were packed to the capacity almost every night, recounted Peter Gamble to the Winnipeg Free Press in 1987. The Winnipeg roller rink was the largest of the three, and it wasn't unusual for more than 1,300 people to pack the northern Maplewood floor on a Sunday night, he said. In the 1950s, roller skating culturally declined.
Well, I was working with Bob Beach, and I was running the rink. I think it started to decline again. You know, it had, you know, it's like everything else. It has ups and downs, eh?
Former customer Phil Del Biggio, who began skating in 1925 at the ice rink and continued throughout the ages, were called in 1985. The regular group faded away. The two other roller rinks in the city, the Auditorium and the River Park, at the end of Osborne, closed down. Keith Haycock and Ron Corin began frequenting the rink as children in the 1960s.
I started skating in grade 4 in 1967. They used to have roller skating in all the gymnasiums in the school for community schools. And I started there. My friends said, come on, try roller skating. I went, what's that, roller skating? And then I went home and told my dad, and he said, oh, they got a big roller rink downtown. So he started taking me to the rink downtown, and then that was it. I was hooked. The Winnipeg rink, at that time, it was owned by these old owners, and they played the old 30s music. So you didn't hear any music that was on the radios. It was all these old organ grinder music, so you just kind of go there. No one else knew any difference. But they had a lot of the old dance skaters that used to go there, and you'd learn the waltzing dances, and then they had these all these other kind of dancing steps from the 30s, and you'd do it on skates. Girls used to dress that could skate. They'd wear the little dancing outfits, and the guys would wear like vests and suits and bow ties, and it used to be very cool, actually. I was going Saturday and Sunday afternoons when I was like 13 years old, and then I started going during the week once or twice, and I got a bunch of friends to start going, and then I was going like still skating in the gyms on Mondays, and then I was skating Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights, Thursday nights, Friday nights.
So pretty much.
Saturday afternoon, Saturday nights, Sunday afternoon, Sunday nights. At that time, it was also, I mean, it was the skating, but there was no internet, only two channels on the TV. And if you wanted to meet people, girls want to meet guys, that's where you'd kind of go. And that's where I felt more comfortable. That's where I met my wife, was at skating. Yeah.
I met Ron when I was about 3 years old. And we lived down the street from each other. And there was a group of 10 of us that all grew up in this two streets. And we all skated at the rink.
Growing up in the rink, you got to experience Kids Day, which is Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon. You got to... They call it horseback riding, the horse races. And what that was they were little wine barrels with horse's head on it that were put on a pair of roller skates. And you used to sit on the barrel, and someone would push you around the rink. And it'd be a horse race. The atmosphere was different at the Winnipeg rink than it was at the Saints. It was more family-oriented at Winnipeg because Winnipeg has been there. Winnipeg Rink and Galaxy and all that was there the longest. Saints rinks were built basically to make money when the roller skating boom came in. So people were coming and going. Where at the Winnipeg Rink, when you came to the rink, you basically stayed there for like
10, 15 years. You know, you became a family.
You go to parties, you go to movies. We even used to go to Assiniboine Park, and we'd have 30 or 40 people and skate in the park. It was something to do. The rink used to close during the summer because they didn't have air conditioning in it in the beginning. So we had nothing else to do, so we'd grab all the people and as many as we could, and we'd go skating in the park or down Portage Avenue. You felt at home.
A friend had asked me to go one Sunday morning. You want to go roller skating? I'm going, what? And that's how I went. And then started going all the time. Never been in a place with lots of people, and I thought, wow, this is kind of neat. And trying to learn, yeah, I wanted to get better. I guess that's what kept me going.
Fred Verity asserted.
Oh, me, I was there every day. The kids used to come once, twice a week, you know. You'd have a lineup from the front door. You'd have maybe 50 kids waiting to come in, and, you know, by the time you have 200 kids in the rink. And then there was certain nights, you know, like Sunday night was a seniors' night. The kids, yeah. Like the kids, didn't come on that night because we played crappy music. What I mean by crappy music, it was dance music instead of rock and roll and all that.
In the early 1970s, roller skating experienced the greatest surge it had seen in years. The Empire Rollerdrome in Brooklyn claimed to be the birthplace of roller disco, a trend widely popularized in New York City, primarily by the black and gay communities. In an article published in the Winnipeg Free Press in 1979, reflected that roller skating was making a comeback across North America, and that Winnipeg was no exception to the surge, which began in 1977.
The floor used to have 500 skaters. During the week, Mondays it was closed. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, the floor would have about 300 skaters. Wow. Friday night, the capacity was 750 skaters. Friday night would be 600 skaters. Saturday afternoon, 600. Sunday nights would be almost 700. So they would have floor guards, three or four floor guards, that would patrol the floor and make sure everybody kept their speed down and didn't skate all crooked, because if three or four people fell, almost the whole floor could fall because it was so jammed.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine on Saturday, the lineup, when there'd be like 30 kids in line. So a friend of mine, we were the good skaters, we'd go and grab the mops. And when the kids were getting a drink, I'd get the mop and say, oh, excuse me, like I'm working there. My friend would come up and say, the owner wants two Pepsis right now. And I go, the owner of the rink? Okay, just a minute. I got to get two Pepsis for the owner of the rink. So we get the two Pepsis, and I give them to my friend, and everyone would just back off because the owner of the rink wanted his drinks. But they were for us.
They ran out. So she sized, you know, 8, 9, you know, girls size 6, size 5, you know.
Yeah.
They'd run out, like, quick. He'd come outside, like Fred would come outside and say, no more size 8s. Okay, well, we're a size 9, you know, and then we're a size 10. You were like 2 sizes too. Just so you can go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd end up not skating because you can't skate in skates 10 sizes too big.
There was people coming in from Steinbach, Selkirk. Once you knew about the Winnipeg rink and you went there and you saw what was happening, and you knew the people, it was... You were in a comfort zone.
To accommodate the boost in popularity, 3 new rinks opened in the city.
All the good skaters came from the downtown rink because all the other area skaters, nobody knew how to skate because they were just areas that just got their roller rinks. So when we would come to the other rinks, we got used to getting a lot of fights called fags and all this kind of stuff because we were doing all this kind of skating. And the other skaters... they couldn't relate to. They just thought it's just like hockey skating in a circle. But we were doing all that other stuff. But then we'd come in, a bunch of us would come in, and we just would kind of take over the rink, sort of the floor. And if we just would pick on the biggest guy, kind of, and just knock him around a little bit. And then after a few weeks, those guys were following us. So that's kind of how it all started. But after about after the rinks were open, after the year or two, you would know if someone came from the downtown rink and were skiing at the other, we'll say the satellite rinks. Or if they were from the Saints rinks, they'd come to the big rink downtown, and you'd know that they weren't from our rink because they wouldn't skate the same way.
Oh, it was funny back then because you really couldn't go to the other roller rinks because you were a Winnipeg roller skater, and everybody knew who I was, but I actually could go to all the other roller rinks. I used to do shows in them between the sessions. So they let me in for nothing. So, but a lot of people couldn't go because they'd get in fights and stuff. So it was like a turf thing. It was you know, because you're from here, right?
Yeah.
Well, because I remember going to Saints Fort Garry, and the guy kicked us out because we were from one. I remember one guy told me not to skate. He said, "Don't skate good here." And I said, "Oh, who are you?" Like, whatever, right?
Yeah.
He says, "Well, no, they'll just kick you out. They'll kick you out because they don't like people from the Winnipeg Bowl, right, coming down here because they haven't had this little turf thing, right? Just, you know, you're from there and you should stay there. Don't come to our rink."
Ownership of the Winnipeg Roller Rink furthermore changed hands. Ron Korn recalled the shift in music when the ownership changed hands.
The difference of, you know how the ice skaters skate in the Olympics? That's how they would skate with the organ music. Now, when you have the modern music and the jam skaters and all that, and on all skate, everyone would just go in a line and just follow the people, and they'd make up steps. That's where everyone here really started getting into this shuffle jam skating stuff, because you could, they were playing like new music.
Following the roller disco boom, the inner city of Winnipeg suffered an even greater economic decline.
Around in the early 80s, the early 90s, we noticed that the neighborhoods started getting, you know, rougher. And you know what? It was like this any other city you go to. If it was an old area, you know, that'd be where all the drugs were and at nighttime, the hookers and all that kind of stuff. And then they'd come and be in the roller rinks and stuff. And then your cars would get broken into all the time. So a lot of us stopped going to the downtown rink because of the change of the area.
A lot of people in the suburbs, they wouldn't want to send their kids down there, you know, because of the neighborhood, probably even in the 90s. Even when I went there, wasn't so bad, but say 10 years after I went there, it was getting like that already.
In 1990, longtime employee Andre Atkinson bought the roller rink from former owner Bob Beach. With the rink in his possession, he renovated the interior of the building in hopes of making the place look more attractive. Andre's main goal was to bring the Winnipeg Roller Rink back to its former glory.
So I brightened it up. As you know, a hardwood floor. It's kind of a darker looking type of floor. So I painted it blue. A lot of people didn't like that. But I did it because I knew it would make it look bright in there, and it worked. Because people came and go, "Oh, it looks so nice in here now." I got that all the time. You're going to get a handful of people who are going to tell you, "Oh, he ruined it when he did it." No, I didn't ruin nothing.
He refurbished the whole inside of the rink, and he made it just like brand new. And he would keep that rink immaculate when he was interested in it. Of all the rinks I've been to, on all the places I've been, Andre's was like the top three or four rinks that you could go in. The floors they were always clean. Everything was always looked after. Nothing was ever left. Like, you know, you if something broke in the washroom, it was fixed the next day, like a tap. Or someone banged into the wall, it was fixed the next day and painted. You come in there the next day, it would be fixed. If a little piece of rug was torn, it would be fixed the next day. And he made a big security entrance with all heavy glass. He got like security people, and it was the inside of the rink was just all brand new inside. And people were always amazed, because if you'd look at the old building, you'd think, "Oh my God, this place is going to be like a total dump inside." But when you'd walk through the doors, and he had the best sound system. He spent thousands and thousands of dollars on the sound system and perfected it too. And the music was always good, and all the old skaters from the 50s and 60s, they started a club on Sunday mornings. So he started getting that clientele to come back and skate.
Well, Andre got it, bought it, and then he changed the colors around. He put the galaxies, you know, drywalled it, and put benches in, like booths in their actual booths, and had a concession stand, and covered the ceiling with this stuff, put lights in the ceiling. It was all different, made. More modern, but same floor. Painted the floor, though. We painted it with the more like a skating color floor. Before it was just wood, like a hardwood floor.
Although attendance was far below the rink's peak popularity in the Golden Age and the roller disco eras, in addition to being frequented by old-timers and families, in its later years, Galaxy was a popular hangout for neighborhood children and teens. Former manager Melanie Kiriliak recalled,
"When I worked there, it was very... it was interesting that different nights would have different crowds. On a lot of the weeknights, and Friday night especially, we had a lot of the inner-city youth that would come in, and it was amazing the kids that you would see that would come off the street, and they would even tell us that they would give up going to house parties and all sorts of different things. They could have gotten themselves into trouble because they want to be at the rink."
Christine McGilvery, former regular of the rink, recounted a similar story.
"I grew up on Lakeside, and it was like, it was the only thing that I did. Like, there was nothing around, you know, like it kept me out of trouble because most of the kids around there, when they grow up in that area, they tend to get into bad groups and make bad decisions. And it was like, it was the one thing that kept me from bad things and making wrong decisions. So I started going there when I was a child, about 6 years old, and it just became life for me. It was what I did, and it was the only thing that I did in my childhood because there was nothing else to do. It was like less than $5. Tuesday nights were Toonie Tuesdays, so, and he rarely upped the price, like rarely. So it was definitely affordable, especially compared to like if you want to put your kids into like soccer or, you know, like hockey. It's, you know, like they have rental skates. You get free rentals. You just $5 for the couple hours, and then you're good. As soon as you go into that and walk into that place, it was like nothing else mattered outside. It was like you didn't have to worry about your problems because you were skating and you were listening to music, and it was like why even bother thinking about your problems and just have a good time.
Kids that came from families that didn't have anything, didn't have that much clothing, because they felt warm, they felt loved, that they changed their outlook on life, and they changed their life, and now some of them are, like I said, lawyers, some are doctors. There's one little boy I remember, he used to get beat up every Saturday afternoon on the floor by this girl. And I don't know why, but he used to get beat up all the time by this girl. He is now a senator in the United States, and he's married to the girl that used to beat him up.
In 2007, when the University of Winnipeg announced that it had bought the location in order to build a new science complex, the community of Winnipeg was not surprised to learn that this old building was set for demolition. However, despite the rink's imminent demise, there was no doubt that this historic and once vibrant social fixture would be missed from the cityscape.
When I first started working there, it was super packed and like lots of people came, and it was just such a fun place. Like, I never really wanted to work because I've always had friends there, and like it was just super packed, especially Friday nights were like the busiest nights, and he would have all night skates, and those were awesome too. And then eventually, soon as I kind of like stopped working there, it started to go downhill a bit, and then it just became like no one was really interested anymore. And then they found out that it was closing down, and then it's like one of those things where you don't know what you got until you lose it, because now you know that this, we're not going to have a rink anymore, and it's like, it's heartbreaking because, you know, like the kids need something. It'll always be part of my life, even though it's gone.
You know, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. You know, like my friend used to live on Maryland. Like I said, I was down there the other day, and all the houses behind his house, they're just gone for like half a block. They used to be all nice houses. Now they're just not there. So, because nobody, you know, nobody wants to buy them. Are you going to buy a house downtown? Right? So, and I think the roller rink downtown was good, but just the way it's going with the city, it probably would have been gone anyways, I think. Unless they did a historical thing on it. They would have kept the history thing on it, like a historical site, then they couldn't, right? But I think just because the way downtown is progressing and moving, you know, getting rid of all the houses and widening, it was going to be gone.
I don't think it was time for the rink to close, really. Unfortunately, they had their hard times. The building was getting old with the new regulations and everything else. They tried to get it as a historical building, but with the Historical Society, if you do modern renovations on a building, then they won't give you the backing as a historical building, because then you've changed it. And then it just came to the point where they have to do some work to it and bring it up to par with the new inspections, new regulations, and they just couldn't afford it. And University of Winnipeg already had their eye on it 10 years before it closed down, so they just had the city and the university work together, and they wanted that property. And as you can see, the university is buying up a lot of property around here. Well, they're going to be a downtown university. So, yeah, the rink was going to go no matter what.
Of course, I was disappointed like everyone else. I mean, I liked it there. But for me, it was my business. It was a life-changing thing for me. I got to go work now.
So it was, and then when people heard that it was closing, all these people that haven't been skating the last 2 weeks, all these people that hadn't skated for years came down to the rink that stopped skating, and it was like super busy, and all people came from across Canada and everywhere. And there was this guy that was some old army guy. He was like 95 years old, came, and he was watching the news on TV and came, and I had to help him around the floor there. But I've seen so many people come and go, but I've always just kept skating.
The rink underwent many changes from the 1930s to its closure. These changes included the physical appearance of the building, the culture of roller skating, impressions from outside, questions of gang activity, and the role of the rink in the inner city. Although the neighborhood and the clientele changed throughout the decades, the Winnipeg Roller Rink, or Galaxy Skateland, remained a community institution that continued to provide exercise and socialization throughout the development of downtown Winnipeg.